Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois. This is the Closing Market Report. It's USDA Report Day, September the 10th, 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzulo. He's a global commodity analytics and consulting in Lafayette, Indiana. And later in the program, Bruce Bostard of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company will join us to take a look at the agricultural cash grain market. In the second half of the program, we call that the Farming World. Daryl Good will be in studio to discuss this morning's USDA reports. Make sure you stay with us for that. And if you can't hear it on a radio station, listen to it on our website at willag.org. It all happens in this Friday edition of the Closing Market Report. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
This stock and commodity report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from Bates Commodities in Normal, providing clients with the latest market information based on research by ADM Investor Services and other independent sources. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
Report on this Friday afternoon, USDA report day. The numbers settled up in Chicago like this. The nearby September wheat futures down 2 cents on the afternoon, of 7.08 and a half top, a settlement price at 7.04. And three quarters for the afternoon, December 7.36 and three quarters for the soft bread, a penny and a quarter lower. The March down a half at 7.65 and three quarters, in July at 7.41 and three quarters, up 3 cents there. September hard red down a quarter at 7.47 and a quarter. September corn futures 4.64, a settlement price up 7 3/4. December at 4.78 and a half, up 4.78 and a quarter, up 7 1/2. The March corn at 4.91 and a quarter, up 7 1/4. And the May futures at 4.94 and three quarters, up 7 1/4. July 4.97 and a half, up 7 3/4 for the day. September soybeans $10.23 and a half, down 14 1/4. November at 10.31, down 15. January futures 10.40 and a quarter, down 15. The March beans at 10.48, down 14. And July at 10.56 and a quarter, down 13 cents. September meal $8.30 lower at 297.20. Oil at 41.25, up 17. CME Group Livestock, October live cattle, 97.15, up 25 for the afternoon. December at 99.97 and a half, up 32 and a half. September feeder cattle, 111.70, up 27 and a half cents. October's at 111.82 and a half, up 7 and a half. And the October lean hogs, $77.25, 12 and a half cents higher on this Friday afternoon. You are listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a production of Illinois Public Media. Here's what the outside markets look like at this hour. Crude oil futures $76.45 a barrel, up $2.20 today. Ethanol at $1.97, that's 4 3/10 higher. The natural gas up 10 9/10 of a cent at $3.87 7/10. And the heating oil or diesel fuel at $2.10 3/10 of a cent, up 3 4/10 of a cent. Gold futures finished the day at $1,244.50. They were down $4.40. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average just about 42 points higher now at 10,457. The U.S. dollar at 82.7 is down 0.02. The CRB index for the day at 275.14 is up 1.93 on the afternoon. Here's what the weather forecast for the nearby area looks like for Champaign and Urbana and the surrounding areas. This afternoon, cloudy skies, a high of 73. Southeast winds around 10 miles an hour, gusting as high as 15 miles an hour. Then tonight, occasional showers, a few thunderstorms. That'll happen mainly after 1 a.m. in the morning. Lows around 60 degrees. Tomorrow, Saturday, showers, thunderstorms likely, mainly before 1 in the afternoon. It'll be cloudy, then gradually becoming mostly sunny. A high near 77 tomorrow. East-southeast winds at 6 to 10 miles an hour. Chance of precip tomorrow at 60%. Chance of precip, by the way, tonight at 80%. And then tomorrow night, Saturday evening, partly cloudy, a low of 55, west-northwest winds between 5 and 10. And on Sunday, a beautiful day, sunny skies, high near 80 degrees, winds light between 6 and 8 miles an hour. Sunday night, mostly clear, a low around 55. We'll take a more complete look at the weather forecast when we get to the bottom of the hour, and we talk with Steve Hilberg of the Midwestern Regional Climate Center.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. It is a Friday afternoon, September the 10th, USDA Report Day. On the phone line with us, Mike Zuzlo. He's with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting in Lafayette, Indiana. He's been waiting patiently. Good afternoon to you, Mike. How are you today?
Hey, great, Todd. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing very, very well. Looks like it's going to be a good weekend by the time we get to Sunday. And, you know, USDA came out with numbers that were pretty much in line with what the trade was thinking, I think, today. What did you think of it this morning when you saw them?
I think the corn numbers definitely were within line of everybody's thinking, and I think the trade's still thinking that we're going to see even lower corn yields in future reports. I would say that I thought that the yield for beans was a little bit of a surprise for the trade, coming in 0.7 of a bushel higher. I think that was a little bit of a surprise from a standpoint of the newswire estimates, plus the idea that aren't we a little bit early to be stepping in here and raising yield in beans. But the USDA went ahead, I think, with those good pod counts and pushed those yields back up even higher than August numbers. Probably the other maybe surprising feature to the report was the USDA incorporated the Stats Canada number very, very quickly in terms of Stats Canada coming out with 1.5 million, finding 1.5 million more tons of wheat earlier this week in their big report. USDA put that and plowed that into their numbers today, and that ended up giving us 3 million more metric tons of world wheat. I think when I talked to the trade in Chicago, there wasn't one person that I spoke with that wasn't surprised by that, that everybody that I had spoken to had thought that the world wheat ending stocks would at least drop a little bit this month.
And they made sure that was clear. It was written up in the WASDE report in the explanations under the coarse grains and the wheat that they had taken into account what happened in Canada and wrote it as such, I suppose. So the numbers like this, you talked about the beans. They're at a 44.7 bushel to the acre average yield nationwide. That's a record breaker on a record breaking crop of 3.483 billion bushels. Up 50 million from the last month. It's probably important to note, though, while there was an increase in production, they managed to find more usage, and the usage dropped down the ending stocks number.
Yeah, exactly. We saw a reduced old crop bean carryover, and then we also bumped up exports by 50 million bushels, took carryover down 10 million. I suspect, Todd, this will be the highest yield that we'll see by USDA here in beans from here on out. I think this is probably the peak on the yield. So I think the most likely amount of downside in beans would be right here, right now, in the next 30 days. And I would also say that January or December 1st high of 09 of that 1060 and a quarter level for November beans, I would think that'd be kind of a brick wall of resistance. So that's kind of the way I'm setting the marketing plan up after this report comes out, is sell beans. It's probably better to hedge beans over corn here. Corn pays better than beans when it comes to on-farm storage. If you close above 1060 and a quarter, though, in the November contract, then you want to defend those sales because that would be a breakout. And fundamentally, there should be very little in our way right now of allowing the beans to be able to get up above that 1060 and a quarter level without the corn or wheat leading it there, you know, in terms of fundamentals by itself.
On the numbers, USDA, for the average price, cash price received by producers in this marketing year, so it's got some numbers filled in already for, well, I suppose they fill them in based on what they think has been made in sales or have been reported in sales for soybeans for the new crop. They're suggesting a 915 to 1065 average cash price range for the year. That's up 65 cents on both ends for the soybeans. And in the corn, they raised it 50 cents, and now they have a range from $4 to $4.80 with a $4.40 midpoint on the corn. That is a record breaker on the price for corn, and they have the largest corn production on record, too.
Yeah, and you're dealing with the U.S. carryover now. The stocks-to-use ratio now is down to a 15-year low, and like I said, you could go sub 160 probably in terms of a final yield number if the yields for corn on beans don't improve dramatically. I just talked to a good contact up in the Ford Iroquois area right before we went on the air, and they're like a lot of people we've talked to, 10 to 50 bushels less, corn on corn the worst, and that dry August and that early water log spring that allowed us to get a lot of holes put into those cornfields, they're really showing up. And so if you don't move into a better yield when it comes to moving from corn on corn to corn on beans when we get to combines in those fields, then you're probably looking at even a lower yield. And that's where the wheat and the corn will continue to play off each other here, I think.
And what they do with the usage numbers there in the corn pit then?
For the corn, they kept the exports, or they raised the exports 50 million bushels, but they took down the feed by 100 million bushels. And I think some people in the trade are really wondering whether that's going to happen or not, because by the same stroke of the pen, USDA somehow increased the world coarse grain demand at the expense of wheat, saying that we're going to send and import more coarse grains into the EU27, and that took down the wheat consumption globally. So is this bringing up an issue where we're going to see the domestic corn producer or corn end user, like the ethanol and livestock guy, get up and have to fight for every bushel against the export market for the people that would normally buy wheat in the European Union, who will now bring in coarse grains like corn and barley? And I think there again, Todd, the major point in this report to me was, if we're going to go a whole other leg up in the corn and we're going to price in these very, very low carryover numbers and a sub-160 yield, I've got to think the cash market is going to need to do that, because the basis, in my view, if we've got U.S. stocks-to-use ratios at 15-year lows and yet basis continues to widen as the futures goes up, something's got to give, and I think it goes back to that feed and export utilization battle that we're probably going to see here in the next couple months.
Yeah, a couple of things. You mentioned the ending stocks. I haven't given those numbers out, and we'll go back to the soybeans ending stocks now. You said down 10 million, they'll be at 350 million. That's a big number, actually, for soybeans, and we've talked about that in the past.
Yeah.
And then in the corn, they're down, what, 205 million, if I remember correctly, to 1.1 billion bushels on the carryout.
That's right, and I think at this 480 level that we struck, you know, we met a really neat chart objective, swing objective today in Dease corn. It's really interesting, date-wise and price-wise, from July 27th to August 5th, we rallied 63 cents in Dease corn, taking the August 25th low to today's high, which is almost the exact same time period. We rallied 64 cents off the low from August 25th. So I think with this last 64-cent increase in price in that 480 level, I think the trade's already carrying probably right around an 875 carryover in corn. So I would suspect they're close to 200 million bushels underneath just today's numbers by USDA.
Well, let me think about that. So we increase. Is that all going to come out of usage somewhere, right?
I think what we're looking at is if we take 2.5 bushels off the yield, we're looking at that type of a carryover where we go from 1.1 down to around an 875. But like I said, I think the trade's already pricing that in terms of where we're at in Dease futures right now. The trade has done a good job since the June 30th report of building extra risk premium in ahead of USDA's number. They got caught with their pants down in June. I don't think they want to do that again.
Come back with me just a second,
sure,
because I don't have the number in front of me. 50 million more in exports. What they do in ethanol? They raised it, right, just a bit.
I thought they kept that the same.
Did they keep
that
same?
And
so we only came up with 50 more million bushel in exports.
They cut the feed by 100 million,
right,
and they raised exports by 50.
I'm trying to get to 250 million. We bantered that around in extra usage, but it didn't show up this time around.
No, not at all. In fact, we came in with total usage came in at 13.44, and the previous month was 13.49. We actually lost 50 million versus last month
because of the domestic
on
the livestock feed.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, what I'm talking about as far as what the trade's pricing in is almost all yield at this point, in my opinion.
All right. Thank you so much.
Hey, thanks, Todd.
Yeah. No. Okay. That's Zuzulo, Mike Zuzulo. That is. He's with Global Commodity Analytics and Consulting. A good conversation with him this afternoon, right here on the Closing Market Report. If you'd like to hear it again, of course you can do that off of our website. The address is willag.org, and there you can listen to Commodity Week. Roy Huckabee of the Lynn Group will be our guest. We'll post it by about 6 o'clock this evening. Commodity Week. It's our weekly look at what happened in the marketplace. We record at 4:30 on Friday afternoons.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and Moline. More information is available from Tim Wells in Moline at 309-797-7369. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Dave Dickey is here now with today's agricultural news.
in agricultural news, the Wall Street Journal today reports that USDA experts knew about sanitary problems at one of the two Iowa farms at the center of a massive nationwide ag recall, but did not notify health authorities. Bacteria found in chicken feed used at the two Iowa farms was linked to a salmonella outbreak that prompted the recall of more than a half billion eggs. The journal says USDA daily sanitation reports underscored regulatory gaps. The USDA said it did not give notice because, quote, the conditions at the egg plant packing facilities were routine. The U.S. Commerce Department is continuing work to reshape the way it determines whether imports are being dumped on the U.S. market. U.S. officials appear to have convinced the European Union that they are sincere in saying they will find a way to resolve the problem. The WTO earlier gave the EU permission to impose trade sanctions on U.S. imports due to the U.S. use of zeroing in anti-dumping proceedings. The EU this week agreed to suspend WTO arbitration proceedings that would have determined the amount of regulatory trade sanctions the EU could impose. The suspension will remain in force for 12 months, but can be terminated any time before then at the request of either the EU or the United States. The administration says it remains committed to moving stalled free trade agreements with Colombia and Panama. Francisco Sanchez, Commerce Undersecretary for International Trade, said earlier this week that the problems that have delayed the FTAs are, quote, workable. It is unlikely, though, that the White House will attempt to move the two agreements during the 4 weeks before Congress adjourns on October 8th. China's trade surplus hit its second highest level this year in August, likely fueling U.S. demands for Beijing to ease currency controls. Chinese custom agency reports say that August export growth fell to 34.4%, but import growth rebounded to 35.2% from the previous month's 22.7%. The trade surplus narrowed from July's 18-month high of $28.7 billion, but was up 28% from a year earlier. Meanwhile, a major U.S. union has filed a trade complaint asking the Obama administration to crack down on what it says is improper Chinese government aid to clean energy industries such as wind and solar power. The United Steelworkers Union says that Chinese aid violates global trade agreements and is hurting American workers. The administration has 45 days to decide whether to accept the petition and launch an investigation that could lead to cases being filed against China before the Geneva-based World Trade Organization. And that's a look at today's agricultural news.
Hey, thanks, Dave. Dave Dickey is Director of Agricultural Programming for Illinois Public Media. That's public radio for the farming world. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Well, up next, events that occur during the development of an infant's brain can leave behind fingerprints. And researchers right here on this campus have found a new model to study how those fingerprints can predict future behavior and cognitive deficits. The baby pig. I'll have more in a moment.
Support comes from Stewart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks. The firm develops strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is available at www.stewart-peterson.com.
U of I researchers discovered that newborn pigs are capable of being trained in traditional learning and memory tests. As a result, these piglets can provide critical information that could directly benefit human health, says animal scientist and researcher Rodney Johnson. A study suggests, he says, that inadequate nutrition, stress, and infection leave fingerprints in early brain development that can make a person more vulnerable to behavior disorders later in life. He's interested in learning how the brain develops during this time and has a goal to understand how to promote optimum brain and cognitive development and minimize potential experiential influences that might hinder that process. Well, the use of the pig in neuroscience research is gaining popularity because pigs are anatomically similar to humans and many of their organ systems grow and develop similarly as well. Pigs are precocial, meaning they are born with well-developed sensory and motor systems. This also allows them to be very mobile and weaned at an early age. Here's another important factor. The pig's brain growth spurt occurs perinatally, a little before and a little after birth. The brain's rapid growth spurt is a critical period of time, Johnson says. We know that if something goes wrong during this development period, the brain can be permanently altered, and he believes that events occurring during this development period may underlie some of the behavioral problems that emerge later in life. In the U of I study, piglets were weaned from their moms at 2 days of age and set up with a milk system that delivered 14 small meals a day, mimicking the number of meals they'd received from their mother. At 2 weeks of age, piglets were trained to locate a milk reward in a maze. The piglets learned quickly after day one where to find this reward, but then a twist was added to the test. The milk was moved from behind the visual cue the piglets used to find it. That cue stayed in place, but didn't have the reward. It took longer for the piglets to figure this out, but they did. Now comes some more science. Some of the piglets were given a shot that stimulated the immune system as if a common virus were present. Their cognitive abilities decreased. The viral mimetic also increased pro-inflammatory cytokines in the hippocampus, a brain area involved in certain types of learning and memory. Pro-inflammatory cytokines in the hippocampus inhibit memory consolidation, making it more difficult to learn. The question then, yet to be answered, is might this have an impact on cognitive abilities later? Using pigs as models might very well lead to some answers. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report on a Friday afternoon. On the phone line with us, take a look at the cash grain market, Bruce Bostard of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company. Good afternoon to you, Bruce.
Good afternoon. I'm glad you had to do those pronunciations.
Yeah, well, you know, I didn't get it right the first time, I promise. I read them several times. Speaking of reading several times, did farmers ask you to read the USDA report several times during the day, especially that increased number for soybeans?
Yes, we did. Quite a bit of looking that, and it's an interesting number out here. I mean, you kind of a surprise on the pop and carry out on wheat and on soybeans. Corn, as we expected, the market would take a look at that and say, that's nice, but that's not what we're seeing, and kind of move on from there.
What is cash grain basis doing as we go through harvest?
The corn has just been very steady, sitting at a 37 under here at Paxton and letting the board do the work of running up. Soybeans, the new crop numbers have been steady. The quick shipment processor premiums and export premiums continue to erode as we see more bean harvest taking place.
And what are your bids for the day?
We are at 441 on nearby corn and 1010 on nearby bean.
And very quickly, are yields less than expected for corn?
Less than expected, maybe 20% less than last year.
Okay, thanks so much.
Moistures are dry.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much.
Bye.
That's Bruce Bostard. He's with the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. He joins us on a Friday afternoon. Back in 2 minutes when we'll take a complete look at the agricultural weather forecast. Steve Hilberg will be here.
It's hot dog day. The first recorded hot dog sausage as we know it today was eaten by the Greeks from at least 850 BC. But the idea of putting a hot dog on bread dates to 1880. By the way, baseball and hot dogs go back to at least 1893, when you could go to Sportsman's Park and catch a St. Louis Browns game and grab the newfangled hot dog. On this day in agricultural history in 1898, Waldo Seaman was born. An American chemical engineer, his technical leadership led to the discovery of three major new polymer families: thermoplastic polyurethane, synthetic natural rubber, and oil-resistant synthetic rubbers. In 1859, Thomas Nuttall died, an English naturalist and botanist. He collected and studied plants around the Chesapeake Bay area in the U.S. In 1913, the official route of the Lincoln Highway was announced. It was the first coast-to-coast highway running from New York to San Francisco. And in 2001, the first case of mad cow disease in Asian animals was reported in a dairy cow in Japan. And that's this day in agricultural history.
The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media. It's a Friday afternoon. Time to check the agricultural weather forecast. Steve Hilberg, the director of the Midwestern Regional Climate Center, funded in part by NOAA, is on the phone line with us. Good afternoon to you, Steve.
Good afternoon, Todd.
Let's start with the weather forecast. There is rain in the forecast for this part of the world, and it is the remnants of a hurricane. Where does it cover? Where does it start coverage areas in the Midwest? Who gets rain and who doesn't, and how much?
Well, actually, the picture is going to get sort of muddled in terms of the weather systems. Hermine is really not much of anything right now. They can't even really detect circulation even on the surface. But we're combining that with another cold front approaching the Midwest this weekend. And so as moisture associated with Hermine gets drawn up into the circulation ahead of the front, we'll see showers and thunderstorms developing. It looks like likely overnight tonight, probably a little bit before midnight in the western part of the state, and then gradually spreading northward during the night and early morning hours. Looks like the heaviest rain, and heavy is sort of relative. I don't know that we're going to see huge amounts anywhere, but will tend to be in central and southern Illinois with much lighter amounts further north. The front's going to sweep through here tomorrow morning, and by noon, I wouldn't be surprised we're seeing some breaks in the clouds with sunshine by afternoon. So it's going to be a rather short duration event, but we should pick up a little bit of rain across much of the state.
And once the sunshine comes, looks like it's going to stay with us.
Yeah, it is. It's going to be a beautiful Sunday. Temperatures back generally staying in the 70s, I think, maybe near 80. High pressure will be building in during the week, and a little bit of warmer weather towards the end of the week as the high moves into the Appalachians and we get into that southwest flow up on the backside of the high. And then toward next weekend, there's another possibility for some rain as another front comes through. But, you know, I think 90 degrees is going to be a thing of the past. I think it's going to be something we're not probably going to see much anymore until next spring sometime. So looks like we got some great fall weather coming on. And once we get past the rain this weekend, we should have some very good drying conditions again.
Just kind of the opposite of what we were messing around with at this time of year last year.
Absolutely. I'm actually amazed to see, I mean, the driving back and forth from home every day, out into the country, how many soybean fields even are being harvested at this time. And, you know, of course, the corn's been going now for over a week. But it's pretty the contrast is pretty amazing considering a lot of these fields were still standing at Christmas last year. So
indeed they were. So if you look out into the end of September, October, and maybe talk about what climatologically usually happens at those points and when we get our first frost dates and those kinds of things, that's not going to have much of an impact on corn or soybeans by any means, but we'd like to know when they are.
Right. Well, typically we see the frost dates early, obviously earlier north and then later in the south. Northern part of the state, first 10 days of October is not unusual to see the first freezing temperatures. Here in central Illinois, it's around the middle to beginning of the third week of October. And then, of course, down in southern Illinois, it's more toward the end of October to the first week in November. Now, that's the median or average date. That can vary, of course, any year. And we frequently see dates on either side. But that's pretty typical. It looks like this can be a pretty normal fall, I think.
Thanks much, Steve.
All right, Todd.
Steve Hilberg with the Midwestern Regional Climate Center. Stay with us for the farming world if you can.
Learnard Seed Service supports agricultural programs as an additional service to its customers. Learnard Seed Service is an independent dealer providing DeKalb and Asgrow seed products, including Genuity SmartStax corn hybrids, to farmers throughout East Central Illinois. Learnard Seed Service, 217-497-2270.
This is the Farming World from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Daryl Good, ag economist from the U of I, joins us in studio to talk about this morning's USDA crop production and WASDE reports. Thank you so much for coming in today, Daryl. We do appreciate that. The numbers were not unexpected, but interesting, I suppose, nonetheless, that came out from USDA today. What'd you find?
Well, I think you're right, Todd. We're always very interested in the numbers, even if the totals or averages come out near expectations. There's always some interest in the details. I think the most interest in the report, obviously, was the any change in the forecast for the U.S. average corn yield, and USDA did lower that forecast by 2.5 bushels to 162.5. Not completely unexpected, but does confirm that we did lose some yield potential in some of the drier areas. It appeared to me that the largest yield reductions came in those states where the crop is maturing the earliest. We saw sizable reductions in Illinois, Indiana, Kansas, Missouri, and to some extent Ohio, where we saw yields unchanged to modified just a little bit, I think, are in the later maturing areas, Iowa and to the north, Minnesota, Wisconsin, the Dakotas. So kind of says to me that as those crops mature and get harvested, we may see those yield numbers come down just a little bit as well. So I think there is some general expectation that in October the number could come down marginally one more time to reflect this trend that we've set up here this month.
Off the open this morning, the traders in Chicago weren't impressed, apparently, that there was much that had changed from what they were thinking ahead of time. Not much of a move in the corn market. On the other hand, when you consider what the trade's been talking about in the terms of the price of corn in the future, and there are $5 and $6 numbers bantied around when we're down at 162.5 or maybe lower for the corn crop eventually, those numbers are pretty lofty. They didn't change very much this morning, and it's probably important to note, I think, two things, that this is still the largest crop on record harvested in the United States, and USDA says we'll be trading from $4 to $4.80 on the cash market. They give a range. It's not really a trade, but on the cash, that they don't even make the $5 mark.
No, and again, the range that USDA is looking at is the range in the average price. They don't really publish a range of the extremes in prices. So if we were to average at the upper end of that range of $4.80, we'll clearly have to see times when prices are well over $5. So, but still, the midpoint of that range, if we average $4.40, that's pretty impressive. That would be a record high corn price with the largest crop we've ever harvested. So I think it continues to speak to the strong demand that we have for corn domestically and in the world. When we can increase production, we consume more than we produce, and we see higher prices. That's just classic strong demand market.
And speaking of which, what did they change in the world of demand?
Basically, on both old crop and new crop, USDA raised their export number on corn. I think both were expected because we have the weekly numbers and the census numbers on the old crop. We knew we were running a little bit ahead of USDA's projection, but not much, 5 million bushels. Jumped new crop exports, 50 million. Old crop ethanol use raised 35 million bushels. The biggest change was a 100 million bushel cut in feed and residual use for next year. So USDA, I think, must be implying that the higher prices may cut into feed demand just a little bit as we move forward. Certainly probably will not cause any liquidation of livestock numbers, but will probably prolong any expansion in livestock numbers.
Historically, and I'll use the word rationing, I'm not sure that that's quite right in this case, but it does to some extent fit. Historically, has the domestic usage livestock Is that where really things start to adjust first when you're in a short supply situation?
Clearly, that's the case. When we've seen periods of extremely high prices and or short supplies in the past, for the most part, the adjustment is made in the domestic livestock industry. Right now, domestic use for ethanol is pretty locked in because of mandates and tax credits. If those are extended beyond December 31st, we'll keep that demand strong over very high prices. Similar with exports, we think exports are sensitive to prices and exchange rates, but they're really not. Importers tend to buy what they need. They certainly adjust the timing of when they buy based on price expectations, but they have to meet domestic consumption needs, and they will do that over a very wide price range. So the adjustment tends to get forced back to the domestic livestock industry.
I want to go back to the 162.5 that they pegged. It's a little bit above the number that has been showing from the models from the University of Illinois. Some understand that those models get updated every week. Others don't. So most are thinking it was at 158.1 a few weeks ago when there was quite a splash made.
Yeah.
It's updated as of last Monday, and it'll be updated again, I suppose, on the coming Monday or Tuesday, somewhere thereabouts. What's the number show?
Well, we have a series of models that we use to come up with the a point estimate on yields, and we do incorporate information in the USDA report beginning in August and continuing in September. So we have our own models, and then we look at information that we don't have that becomes available in the USDA report. And so we, from August forward, we can use that information. But we're still, as of last week, we were at 158.8 on our yield estimate, and that's likely to come down just a little bit because of the new information in the USDA report. And particularly if crop condition ratings would come down another point or two, that would affect our forecast. But we're pretty locked in. You know, 158, 159 is where we're going to end up with our yield expectation for this year.
And so your models include the crop production and WASDE report, some numbers from those places?
Once that information becomes available, we don't throw it away. We use all the information available. And our models are just models, and they don't substitute for measuring crop, and they don't substitute for harvest results. So we don't throw that information away when we forecast the average yield.
And the crop production reports, which come on Monday, and then some other type of modeling information. So the next one could be a fairly interesting, at least to look at it, in terms of once you've got all this extra data in it, I would think.
Yeah, I mean, we update it on a weekly basis, and with the USDA providing information that yields are a little bit lower than they forecast before, that will probably lower our forecast as well, just a little bit. So marginally, not very much. So it's going to change our forecast by a decimal point. We're pretty much locked in right now.
You think the supply and demand figures from USDA are pretty on the mark at this point?
Yeah, I don't have any argument with their numbers. One thing that's still curious that we've been talking about for some time is still on the old crop, what appears to be a very large feed and residual use of corn, kind of out of line with where we've been on feed use and where USDA thinks we're going. This past year looks to be awfully big on feed and residual use. And we'll rectify that when we get to September stocks number at the end of this month. Wherever stocks come in, then we can calculate backwards and see what that feed and residual was. Does it verify or not? And but other than that number, everything looks logical at this point. That one stands out a little bit as being unexplainable, but there is noise.
About that one earlier in the year, and that's one number that actually could change the picture to some extent, I would suppose.
It could. I mean, you think of three or four scenarios that could happen. One is we find corn in the September report, which suggests that feed and residual use wasn't as large as we thought. And so we come in with a bigger than expected September 1 stocks number. We come in as projected on September 1 stocks, and USDA doesn't change their feed and residual use. Just we live with it and say that's the noise in those numbers. Or at a real low probability scenario would be that we confirm the projected September 1 stocks or come in even a little smaller, which then would perhaps force some revision of the size of the 2009 crop. Very unlikely, but you'd have to say that that is one potential scenario that could unfold depending on what the September 1 stocks number really is.
So one says the 2000, that last one says the 09 crop wasn't as big as USDA thought it was. The other says, well, we've got more left over than we thought. And will it show up in the crop production or in the WASD figures at some point then?
Yes.
So it gets incorporated, right?
Right. Once we get the September stocks number, then beginning with the October WASD, we'll see that. If we leave the feed and residual use at the high number right now and it doesn't get changed, I mean, one implication is that some have suggested is that's the result of a poor quality crop that we harvested in 2009. We had to feed more bushels to get the output. So it's will be interesting to talk about, but soon forgotten, I think, once we get into the October production numbers.
I'm sure it will be. We better catch the soybeans before I let you go. Let's talk about those numbers as they came out from USDA today.
Again, the two or three interesting changes. One, the production number went up about 50 million bushels. USDA suggesting a record yield of 44.7 bushels, 7/10 above both the August forecast and last year's record yield. Offset a little bit by larger exports on both old crop and new crop. But kind of underneath, you see USDA also lowered their estimate of residual use of soybeans or unexplained use of soybeans for the last year. And it's kind of curious, if you look at the projection for the upcoming year, that residual category is at 70 million bushels. Last year, they're saying 26 million. The year before, 16 million. That residual number is just a residual number, and it has a lot of noise in it, but it looks unusually small the past 2 years. The crop was slightly different size than estimated. But again, it opens the door a little bit for maybe a surprise in the September stocks report. Maybe in the opposite direction of corn, we could find a little tighter stocks of soybeans than currently forecast. But having said that, the focus is really going to be on the size of the crop and then the rate at which we're exporting and crushing. The good news in this report was USDA is now projecting exports this year almost as large as the record we had this past year, even with bigger shipments out of South America.
And when you do the subtraction and the addition in terms of larger crop size, bigger exports, you come out with a smaller carryout.
Slightly smaller carryout. USDA now projecting 350 million versus last month's projection of 360. But interestingly enough, the projection of the marketing year average price did increase quite a bit month over month. Looking again at the midpoint, I think they went up about 65 cents on their projected marketing year average cash price. And as inventories build by 200 million bushels this year, the midpoint of the USDA's price projection is that we average 30 cents higher than we did last year. So again, I think it speaks to the really strong demand. The one figure I think we have to be a little bit leery of is the projection of soybean oil use for methyl ester or biodiesel, USDA projecting an awfully big increase. I think we're going to have to see the blender's tax credit come back in order to get that.
Daryl, thank you so much. Daryl Good, ag economist from the University of Illinois. By the way, the USDA range for the cash price from $9.15 to $10.65. I'm Todd Gleason.
It's hot dog day. The first recorded hot dog sausage as we know it today was eaten by the Greeks from at least 850 BC. But the idea of putting a hot dog on bread dates to 1880. By the way, baseball and hot dogs go back to at least 1893, when you could go to Sportsman's Park and catch a St. Louis Browns game and grab the newfangled hot dog. On this day in agricultural history in 1898, Waldo Seaman was born. An American chemical engineer, his technical leadership led to the discovery of three major new polymer families: thermoplastic polyurethane, synthetic natural rubber, and oil-resistant synthetic rubbers. In 1859, Thomas Nuttall died, an English naturalist and botanist. He collected and studied plants around the Chesapeake Bay area in the U.S. In 1913, the official route of the Lincoln Highway was announced. It was the first coast-to-coast highway running from New York to San Francisco. And in 2001, the first case of mad cow disease in Asian animals was reported in a dairy cow in Japan. And that's this day in agricultural history. This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming, Dave Dickey. Coming up next, year in and year out, Illinois is among the top states in the nation when it comes to producing corn and soybeans. But early in the 20th century, Illinois was among the top producers of another crop, one which is now seeing resurgence. Lisa Brautz has the story in her latest edition of In My Backyard.
Hey, guess what? Harvest is happening right now. The grape harvest, I mean. It may not dominate the landscape the way the corn and bean harvests do here in Illinois, but as we start to lose daylight toward the autumnal equinox, there are people all over Illinois picking grapes to make wine. Commercially. I freely admit that I was mostly unaware that Illinois is wine country until a few years ago. Before that, my knowledge about winemaking was limited to a couple of Mad Men-era paperbacks I picked up at a yard sale for their aesthetic value, not for their contents. And I was also hip to the activities of a few enterprising folks in my circle who are making their own hooch from fruit. Until recently, that was the extent of my Illinois wine knowledge. Enter one Bradley Beam, an enologist for the Illinois grape and wine industry, and a winemaker himself. Enology is a study of wine and winemaking, and Brad is wildly conversant not just in enology, but also in viticulture, which is a study of growing and harvesting the grapes. He likes to make wine. Says Brad.
In my opinion, life's always better when there's something fermenting.
Brad told me that Illinois actually has a pretty long history of grape production, but Prohibition derailed things and the comeback has been slow in coming. But it's definitely happening. In the early 1980s, there were only three wineries in Illinois, but now there are more than 80, with between 400 and 500 growers actually growing grapes. Not that you'd know. No one in Illinois is doing big-time commercial grape growing for winemaking, which means that there's often a shortage of Illinois-grown fruit to make wine with.
Hopefully, what Illinois really needs at this point is someone who's willing to jump in and produce a large vineyard, talking 30 to 50 acres, somebody that's really ready to get serious about it, and we have the wineries that will definitely buy that fruit.
Interest in eating locally and in consuming value-added products made by local producers has helped along interest in locally produced wine.
Winemaking in the wine industry really is a value-added agricultural product. That's how I think of it anyway. It's locally produced fruit. Turned into something that you can actually make a little bit of money on. Any fruit product, really, if you actually produce it into jams or jellies or some kind of product that you can sell as a unique product, you actually can increase the value of it. And grapes are no exception.
The main issue here, why more locavores and, heck, wine drinkers don't know much about the Illinois wine scene is twofold: a lack of consumer education and a lack of larger scale production, though both are improving. Brad feels that, despite their quality, Illinois wines suffer from a lack of identity. What makes them unique is the grapes they're made from. But lack of general knowledge about Chambourcin and Traminette and Frontenac, all grape varieties that grow well here and make up our wines, means that many wine drinkers think Illinois wine should taste like wine from California or Oregon, even though the grapes used are different.
And I think that's what makes us special.
This is Joe Taylor. He and his wife, Dawn, started Sleepy Creek Vineyards in Oakwood, Illinois, about 3.5 years ago.
We can actually bring in grapes from California, probably cheaper than we could from other Illinois varieties. But why make something that's already made quite well out there? So we decide that we're going to stick with the Midwest wines, things that can be grown here in Illinois. And to me, I think that's what makes the product a little different and a little more interesting.
Joe got started making wine at home using kits just over a decade ago. He and Dawn started planting vines a couple of years later. Then, inevitably, came the winery and accompanying chalet-style tasting facility. Dawn gave me a short tour.
We're standing here in our wine manufacturing facility, commonly known as a winery. And this is where we process all the grapes, age the wine, bottle the wine, store the wine. Back here we have numerous stainless steel tanks where the wine is being aged. We have equipment back here like filters and presses and crushers and chillers and bottlers and corkers. So all that's back here in this tiny little room.
Sleepy Creek now offers 7 varieties of wine, whites, reds, a rosé, with plans to add a couple more. Joe doesn't feel that their lineup needs to feature more than 10 offerings because having more could be overwhelming at tasting events, he says. The winery produces about 5,000 gallons of wine each year. Pretty good for a boutique winery in central Illinois. So, was 2010 a good grape year, I asked. I was surprised to learn that the answer was not really. While grape growers are often at the mercy of the weather wasn't so much the problem this year. In this area, we had good rain at the beginning of the season and lots of dryness to close it out, which grapes like. The problem has been chemical drift. In this case, the drifting on the wind of herbicides that are designed to kill any plant that isn't the plant being sprayed. The major culprit right now is herbicide applied to golf courses and lawns, but the Taylors fear the stronger herbicides being developed for application to commodity crops. This is a big issue for specialty crop farmers, said Joe, but it's especially big for wineries that also grow grapes and are agritourism destinations. We'll see what the future holds. In the meantime, Bradley Beam feels good about Sleepy Creek's chances.
Sleepy Creek Vineyards is a winery and vineyard that's pretty close to my heart because they started their operation just as I first took the job at University of Illinois as a state enology specialist. So we kind of grew into our jobs together, and because they were so close, I spent some time out there and worked with them, especially in the early days when I was trying to help them kind of get off the ground and hit the ground running, so to speak. They are, in my opinion, a great example of an Illinois small winery making it happen and making it work.
Wine from Illinois. Who knew? And it's right here in your backyard.
Lisa Brott's stories can also be heard on our website, WILLAG.org. Click on the In My Backyard link in the right navigation window. And you can also read her occasional blogs at majorprogression.wordpress.com.